This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for January 26th, 2021. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. My name is Drew Messenger Michaels, and I'm very glad you're here. So I said a week, and it was longer than a week. That is because the world was a little bit on fire. And as I said on Twitter, things being how they were, folks were not actually that excited to talk about their video game projects for a little while. But things have calmed down somewhat here in the US, and as such, we are back on schedule. We shuffled a few guests around. We're still going to be able to bring you, I believe, everybody who we thought we were going to, but in a somewhat different order. So, first up, this week, Chell Wong. She's a rather accomplished composer and sound designer. You may know her work from Kine, and you may soon know it from Watch This Space, the new game from It's Anecdotal. We talk about that. We talk about Chell's approach to composition, as well as her approach to just sort of being in the world. I think it's a pretty good talk. We're glad to be back. I'm glad you're here with us. Enjoy. So thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. The first question I would normally ask would just be like, tell me about, you know, what is Game X that you're working on? But in your case, it's not just one game. You are working on like a lot of stuff all the time. Is that fair to say? Is there something that you are mostly working on right now, or is there a ton of stuff in the pipeline?
So here's the thing. I unfortunately actually don't have anything super duper serious happening right now. I've been looking for things. It's pretty difficult to say the least. I was laid off in October, and so that has been a bit of a scramble. But hopefully there are some things on the horizon. There are a few small things, one of which I can't talk about yet. The other which, it's called Only Cans.
I know what that's a reference to, but yeah.
It's what if OnlyFans, but for soda cans, and it's really high production, and it's way better than it should be. I only did a little bit of work for it, but I'm doing a little bit more as we, well, not right now, but I'm doing sure. More for some upcoming stuff for it. And it's just like, am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Absolutely, yes.
It's a bunch of bullshit made by a bunch of people who are way better at stuff, and they decided to say, what if, I honestly don't remember the inception of this because I wasn't there for it, but then they're like, hey, who wants to be part of this bullshit video game that we're making? And I was like, yeah, do you guys need anything? And they already had some royalty-free music, but they were like, what about a jingle? And I'm like, sure. So I whipped up a jingle, and I wrote a better version of that. So that's kind of like the only... Oh, actually, there is a game of mine that is coming out in a month called... actually, sooner than a month. It's called Watch This Space, and it's by It's Anecdotal. And I believe that's coming out February 2nd. Let me double check that, actually.
We had an It's Anecdotal episode of this very podcast back when 39 Days to Mars came out. So, yeah, that's super exciting.
Oh, dang. Yo, yeah. Philip is such a cool guy.
Philip rules. Like Philip, yeah. Yeah, I played the demo. It's really cool. Because for anybody who hasn't checked it out, it's like a sort of an Asteroids or Space Invaders-like, but with very specific character abilities that like break the game or change the rules. So it's like a cross between an old school space shooter and like an Iceberg Vania changing the rules of the game in the game.
It's February 9th. Cool. And yeah, it's a party game of Asteroids, but the rules change and the characters all have their own unique abilities. And what I did for that game is like, I like to specialize with very layered music and very modular stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything that locks me particularly to a genre. It was like kind of a house genre, and then it sort of evolved into something else that I can't really describe. But mm-hmm. essentially, each character has their own theme, and as you're playing the game, whoever is the most winning player at the time has their theme the loudest. And it's still kind of in the works, but the next second place person will have their music kind of like competing with them, and it'll have like different layers of like how loud your theme is playing depending on how well you're doing at the time. And if like ideally, at least if you overtake someone else, then your theme will come out over on top of it. So I haven't had a chance to really tinker with that as much as I would like, but that is the goal, at least to get the music to where I want it to be.
That's incredibly cool. I mean, because that's, to a certain degree, that's what you're known for. You got some recognition very rightly for the Kind soundtrack, which is very much about layers. And like in the text, it's about a band getting started and it's about, you know, different instruments coming in and controlled chaos and all that. So to put that into like a dynamic multiplayer based system seems very much in your lane.
Well, yes. In fact, that is. Thanks. I feel like a lot of people don't necessarily know about Kind, but
I'm surprised how many people don't know about it, because like it's one of those things that like got like totally lavish praise from everyone who played it, but then it just I feel like it didn't get as zeitgeisty as it deserved to when it was out. I don't know why that happened or didn't, but it was a great game.
It launched October 19th of 2019 on the Epic Game Store, and we were actually also a launch title on Stadia, but as you can imagine, Epic Game Store doesn't have nearly as large of a user base as Steam. Mm-hmm. We did launch a year later, and we also launched on all consoles, so that was the thing. But we didn't launch on Steam, and I think like the majority of players would maybe play there. I know we had a lot of Switch players. Mm-hmm. A lot of times when we were demo at PAX, they'd be like, "Oh, I'm gonna pick this up for Switch," and it was really exciting. So we did launch a year later, again on Steam, but I think also it's a very niche genre. Like, it's the kind of game that I would play if I didn't work on it, and I did play it anyways because I like puzzle games. But puzzles are a very niche genre, so they definitely don't have as wide of an appeal as certain other things. That's definitely a thing.
Yeah, well, it's specifically like spatial reasoning puzzles. Like it's a game about movement, but all the characters move differently because they're sort of based on instruments. And so like you open, you know, you pull back the trombone and then that makes you go more spaces and things like that. So it's like very physical in a way that feels really right on the Switch. But I think you're right. That's not what most people expect when they boot something up. I think the popular imagination of a puzzle game is something more like, I don't know, like Candy Crush or whatever, where the physicality isn't part of it and it's very quick and it's not cerebral in the same way.
Yeah. They're, like, what is a puzzle is such a broad thing. Like, match threes are puzzles in a sense. Like, Sokoban, which is the genre of, like, that 3D, like, grid-based movement.
Block
that is
pushing stuff.
Yeah. That's puzzles. Like, Talos Principle is puzzles. The Witness is puzzles. Monument Valley is puzzles, but also Monument Valley is a gorgeous game, but you can't fail it.
Right.
There aren't like wrong answers that you get stuck. Like, it's not as much about solving as it is like slowly unraveling. And that's not to say that it's better or worse. It's just different. And so
Yeah, no, there are people who will tell you it's only a puzzle if there's exactly one solution. There are people who tell you exactly the opposite. We've had Zach Barth on a bunch of times, and he's very insistent that what he makes are not puzzles. They are something other than puzzles. They are situations or whatever. But I think it is a big broad term. It's almost like game itself, where, you know, there is a strict formalist definition, but there are so many things people engage with that fall outside of that, that it's almost self-defeating to try and be really, really specific about it. Mm-hmm. I feel like Kind, however you define puzzle, however strictly, Kind counts, right? Like,
oh, it's absolutely. Definitely,
yeah. I'm not sure how many like alternate solutions there are to those levels. I've only really kind of played through the whole thing once, but it's
Yeah,
it's great.
Dang, nice. It's not easy.
It took me a minute, yeah, but I did. Yeah, no, it's really good. I mean, I was maybe plugged into the Epic Store sooner than most people because we had, I swear to God, I'm not trying to just drop names, but it's connective tissue. And if people want to listen to other episodes, we had Greg Kasavin on right when Hades launched. And that was probably, that was one of the first big, like, indie exclusive Epic things, right? So we were talking about it before it was cool. Hades is pretty rad.
It's pretty rad. I got 130 hours in it.
Yeah, I actually haven't. It's one of those games where I'm not sure I want to know. And again, it's like across the Epic Game Store and Switch now, so I would have to, you know, do some simple math. But so you got really into it, like the rest of the world?
Oh yeah, I've been slowly climbing each weapon. Is this a spoiler at this point, where it's like you can up the difficulty, and that's called heat. And so I'm on heat 12, or no, I think I'm on heat 13 with everything. I'm like getting to heat 13 with every single weapon. And so there's like a thing that you can get when you get to heat 15. Mm-hmm. I'm just doing them one at a time. And sometimes I just do that while I like talk to other people. And it's gotten to the point where I feel pretty comfortable with it. But there's a... The game is good. It is really good.
It is really good. I always, I kind of have that at any given time. I have a game too that I'm just kind of playing like by default. If I want to just be playing something, that was Hades until I got to Heat 15, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna this is a good stopping point. I'm gonna do something else for a while. Currently, it's Spelunky 2, right? But there's something to that of like whatever game you have that is just, I don't know, meditative, or it's like daily yoga for your brain or your Twitch reactions or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this. You've said, I think, in previous interviews that you were going to be a music teacher and you were going to go into academia and you were, you know, like you were going to go into education and or academia. You were going to get a degree, an advanced degree in bass trombone performance for a while. And then you sort of ended up in games sideways. And you've sort of also said that you consider your chops, not just musical, but networking chops, right? The skill, the underappreciated skill of putting yourself out there. Are those two things like related? Is something I've never really heard you talk about. Is spreading the word and collaborating and like sharing ideas with people as much what it's about for you as like the actual nuts and bolts writing of music, which obviously you're really good at. But I get the sense that what gets you up in the morning is also like finding like-minded artists and making stuff together.
So, let's see. I would say that, I have to think about this. So for me, I'm very much an extroverted person, and the pandemic is rough. If you like hugging people,
yeah,
I miss hugs so much. Gosh, but the biggest thing for me, I would say, is that networking is not as much what I used to think networking was when I was younger. When I was younger and I was still in academia, I would go to these career fairs. There was like alumni events for your college, and I would go, and this guy would talk 3 sentences to explain what his job was, and I didn't understand any of it. And I'd be like, I teach trombone. Do you have a niece or nephew that wants to learn trombone? And this is like, no. And I'm like, cool, I'm gonna keep eating these free macaroons because they're delicious. And they're, oh man, truffle mac. I had this truffle grilled cheese, and that was the only thing I did there. I ate a truffle grilled cheese. I talked to 2 people I knew, and then I left. It was like, it was just such a, But now in games, everyone's a nerd. Everyone likes video games. There are people who love Smash. I love Smash. I'm a big competitive Smash player. I love puzzle games. I love all sorts of things. And I just have such a wide berth of interest in games that I can almost connect with anyone about like a shared interest in something. And even like, obviously, of course, when you're in the industry, there's just like work stuff that you can bond over. But more than that is the passion behind games. For writing music, I would say that it's the passion of discovery and figuring something out. Like, I would say that with writing music, a lot of it comes very intuitive to me, but there's definitely a lot of kind of grinding out something and figuring out different ways to approach it, especially when you have to figure out modular music and very layered stuff and different genres. Like, okay, what makes, I have to write some like cheesy soda can jingle. What makes a soda can jingle sound like? Like, what are different jingles? What sounds very commercial? And or like, I'm gonna write this drum and bass track. I'm gonna write this lo-fi hip hop track. I'm gonna write this. I wrote like crazy cowboy music one time, and it's just like, what are these elements that make it? How do I make it my own? How do I mess around with it? And it's just a matter of like, I don't really think when I write music so much as I put stuff out. The first track I ever wrote for a video game, I sang it into a phone, and then I wrote it out afterwards. So it's just kind of a matter of letting it flow and just experimenting with things is the fun side of things. I guess to an extent, discovering new people could be seen as networking in a sense, and discovering how to write music. So I guess if I were to make a connection, that would be my connection.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I mean, I believe you're wearing a shirt that has to do with the Boston Audio folks. Oh, so that's Boston Fig. Okay. Yeah.
I have a Game Audio Boston shirt though.
Okay. So yes. So you own a shirt that is what I was referring to, which is you sort of, you created, you co-run a group for audio folks in Boston.
I definitely did not create it. Okay. That would be Michael Sweet, who no longer is in Boston. He moved back to LA, and he was an absolute pillar of our community. He was a professor at Berkeley, and he would teach all sorts of game audio stuff to students. And a lot of the members at Game Audio Boston were Berkeley students, his students, in fact. I think he may have also co-founded with Eric Hamill, who is still in Boston, but he's had to arrange his responsibilities, so he no longer co-organizes it. But Yeah, Game Audio Boston is one of like several meetup groups in Boston. I frequent basically all of them for the game industry events in here, but we have Boston Indies, Women in Gaming Boston, Boston Unity Group, Boston Postmortem, which is actually our IGDA branch, and it is older than IGDA itself.
Oh, wow.
So, and of course, Game Audio Boston, which I co-organize. And you mentioned earlier, which is the shirt I'm wearing, is Boston FIG, or Boston Festival of Indie Games. That is an annual, and there's also kind of like smaller things. Like, this is for talks, which is a thing that I talked at. But there was the actual festival itself, which was last week. Yeah, it was last week.
That's amazing. And it's been great to see so much of that, especially, you know, not just for extroverts, but for everybody to see that this stuff continues, you know, as best it can, despite the pandemic. I mean, I guess the last thing I did before the pandemic happened was go to PAX East. So it's like,
same.
Yeah. Which, you know, yeah, my Chromecast is currently tormenting me with pictures from that. Cause it's like, hey, it's been, you know, about a year. Don't you want to see this? I'm like, not particularly. Yeah. Various meals I had and booths I frequented and all that kind of stuff. I also miss that stuff a lot. Is the Boston scene sort of key in your head to how you operate within the game space? I mean, like a lot of what you just listed is pretty regionally specific, where, you know, the internet has no oceans, has no roads, has no distance. But I get the sense that being a part of a local community is really important to you, and it's not hard to understand why. But is that a priority?
Yeah. So I would say that I'm a pretty community person. I go pretty hard on things. Like, I'm also in the Smash Ultimate competitive community, like the tournament regulars. Back when we had tournaments,
right?
I am now part of like this online community for game dev stuff called the Game Industry Gathering,
mm-hmm.
and it is something that I have been described as a geographic landmark, because okay. because GIG is 12 hours long. It starts at 2 p.m. Eastern and ends at 2 a.m. Eastern, and it's got participants from all over the world.
Mm.
And I am at the point right now, the only person that does all 12 hours. Wow. There used to be one other person who's my friend Tiffany Otto, and I love her. But she moved to Australia, and that is just not a time zone that is conducive to that. So right now I'm the person who has done more gig than everyone else. But besides gig, I'm again really big in the Boston community. It started out with me just being like, I gotta meet new people. Because how do you get into the industry? Like, networking is kind of the biggest answer. And like, you gotta make stuff and you gotta put it out there, of course. But like, doing that without meeting new people is just like hoping to be discovered. And that almost never works.
Totally.
Unless maybe you're doing covers, but like, I still wouldn't bank on it. So at some point I was just going to 5 to 6 meetups a month, every month. And then at some point people are like, wow, you know everyone. I'm like, I do. It's just over sure. over like months and months and months of doing 5 to 6 meetups every month, and you meet at least one person each meetup, and you see the same people that met from the previous one, and then now and your friends, and you go to the bar afterwards and you shoot the shit, and then you become someone that knows everyone. And then you I started to co-organize one of them, and now I'm the most senior member of Game Audio Boston. I also help do a little bit of stuff for Boston FIG, not as much as maybe my title may say, but that also was given to me before the pandemic, and the pandemic kind of changed everything. So
sure, yeah, that's fair. It's funny when you talk about your membership in most of these communities or your role in it, you always talk about it as though you're surprised, like, oh, that happened. I mean, even earlier, I think maybe you do this a little less now, but I was listening to some old interviews of yours, and the very fact that you've got sort of a career in game audio, I think, was a surprise to you initially, that it was something you'd thought about for a long time, but then sort of just found yourself actually doing somewhat unexpectedly. Is that fair to say? Like, you pursue these paths and then they lead where they lead.
Yeah, like my whole life, teachers were like, if you like video games and you like music so much, why not just write music for video games? And you, at the time, as a youth, I was like, you can't just do that. And like, arguably still, you can't just do that and make a career out of it. But if it wasn't, like, if it wasn't painfully obvious by how much networking I do, mm-hmm. which again, I consider to be like a bigger strength of mine than you, right? Not that writing music is not a strength of mine. I shouldn't downplay that in a sense, but like, networking is something that I do a lot, and I try, and I don't want to be a skeevy person. I try not to be. I don't think I am. I just I feel like I'm very much who I am on the outside, and I wear my heart on my sleeve, and I just get really excited about stuff, and I really like meeting new people, and so I enjoy it. I do it all the time. And some people see networking as a dirty word. I think that it would be a disservice to pretend that there's zero business aspect of it. That's a lie. I would never, ever, ever claim that. Like, oh, I just want to make friends. And if you want to know, like, there's also, like, of course, meeting new people can potentially lead to new opportunities. But I also just, I don't work with 99.9% of the people I meet. And right. That's fine. I am friends with everyone that I'm friends with through networking. And I support them. And they all do all these cool and crazy things. And they almost always have composers. And that's fine. Because they're great people and they're cool people. But, like, I just really enjoy networking. And so if it wasn't clear by how much I do it and how much I work my ass off to do everything and be a part of things and just know people and also work my ass off on writing music, like, I didn't get here. A lot of it was luck. A lot of it was luck. But you only get a chance to win every time you play. And I play a lot when it comes to making opportunities, meeting people. So,
yeah, no, totally. I guess the reason I brought it up is that, I think people understand that composition is a skill, that playing an instrument, that arranging, that these are concrete skills that you can get better at. I think it's less appreciated that networking is a skill. It's an actual sort of, it's a learnable thing. Some people are naturally better at it than others, but you can improve at it. But I think what you're saying is really important, which is the goal is not to be completely cynical or transactional about it. The goal is not to get a gig out of every interaction or seem hungry. Like, the goal is just to be a person, you know, something.
I've met people like that. I don't know where they are now. Yeah.
Sure. I grew up in LA, so all the time. Oh, yeah. Geez. Yeah, yeah. That thing, if you're at a party and they're like looking over your shoulder to see if there's someone more important than you behind you that they should be talking to. Like, it's a real thing, and it's kind of, you know, gross.
Yeah. It's I mean, it's perfectly reasonable to want to meet people that, like, are in a position that you're like, wow, that they're cool and I admire them. But also, like, I've met a guy who like talked one sentence. He gave me his business card, asked me to come to his thing. It was about VR, which I don't really do. And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, okay. And I put it in my pocket. And then he literally 180 turns around, starts talking to someone else, and just, like, gets them into a conversation, does the exact same thing, gives them a business card after one sentence. I'm just like, I don't know who that person was. I haven't seen them since. We already have a VR meetup.
Right. And that person may not know who they are. I mean, that's the thing, right? Something I've heard you say is that who you are in person is who you are online. Like, I think genuineness is, if there's a secret sauce or whatever to what you do and how you interact with people, I think you just, that seems like it, which seems incredibly obvious when you say it, but is less common than you might think in professional or semi-professional settings.
And I learned all of my networking skills from an introvert, and he is really well-spoken, and He studied a lot. My friend Akash Thakkar, just to put his name out there, because he's great. And I learned, I give credit where credit's due. So Akash is an introvert. I don't think that's a secret, at least. My bad. I don't think it is. but he says that he did a lot of studying. He gave a TEDx talk. And that stuff doesn't come naturally. It doesn't come naturally to him. And even to me, as someone who is an extrovert, like, I trip over my words. I've done so plenty of times in this podcast alone. Like, he speaks better than I do in a sense, but I definitely have an extroverted mentality and energy behind a lot of things. And, like, it is something that one works on, and it you fumble on it. And, like, game audio people have a terrible reputation of, hey, does your game need music? And then you're just that person, and they're like, no, our game's launching in a month. Like, well, of course we don't. And we get a bad rep across the industry as it is already, because we're just gonna desperate people. So
is that, I mean, do you feel like that stereotype is warranted to a certain degree, just because there's a separateness?
Let me tell you, I was like potentially going to try and start a game studio. I don't think that's actually happening, but hey, you know, like, it was something that I wanted to entertain the idea of, and I worked with some friends. And we made a game, and it's going to come out eventually, but I can't talk about it just yet. But essentially, though, when I'm like, hey, I had like this spark of inspiration, and I was just like really into it. I'm like, no, let's just fucking do it. Like, you know, everything comes from something. Like, you know, like Supergiant didn't just become Supergiant. It built over 10 years plus, you know. Totally. every indie studio that you know about, that you love and adore, started from something. Like, what if this is our something? And it might not be, and that's fine. But when I was like, who wants to make a game studio with me? Like, three or to five audio friends was like, hey, if you need, like, music or sound, and I'm like, I love you so much, but no, I'm the audio person. I'm doing this because I need work, right. And I'm looking for work, and I'm trying to start opportunities. Go do it yourself if you want to. Not to be mean, but, like, please, if they do it to me, they do it to everyone. And not those people specifically.
Sure.
They did it because they trusted me and they're my friend. A lot of people do it to people they don't know, and it's just like, it's hard. Sometimes you feel like you got a cold call. Sometimes you do have to cold call, but also it is fair to not like getting cold called and cold emails and all that stuff. And like, it's a fine line to walk.
It is on both sides, right? Because you want to solicit people who are talented and interested, but you don't want to make yourself so open that you get your ear talked off at all times. And on the other side, you want to put yourself out there, but the shotgun approach, like you said, can be both a little bit skeezy and not necessarily that the most effective way to do it. So yeah, it's definitely a fine line, which is why it can be good to bond over other shared interests. You have mentioned Smash a couple of times. I have heard you talk a fair bit about falling out of love with Smash 4. I have heard you talk less about falling
in love with it. I tried to like it and I played it and it just felt terrible. And then badly I played
phrased.
More.
Badly
it
phrased.
Worse. Every single time I play that game, it just feels bad and worse and awful.
Badly phrased. I meant fell out of love with Smash as a result of Smash 4.
Okay, fair.
Yes. And then came back on board. I've heard you talk less about coming back on board with Ultimate, which you said you have, and that's awesome.
Yeah. And they gave me King K. Rool.
Which is amazing.
I didn't have a main. I played Luigi in Melee and Project M, but like there's no equivalent afterwards, and there's no equivalent in basically any other game. And I normally play heavies and tanks and grapplers and like everything. I play like the biggest, heaviest, slowest character in every game. And if not, I play the second biggest, heaviest, slowest character and a little bit of the biggest, heaviest, slowest character, but not in Smash Bros. Pre-Ultimate because God, Bowser and DK just feel terrible to play in Melee. And DK can do some cool stuff. I can't, but yeah, it's like, it's so, it feels so bad. And yeah. I play Zangief. Like, I'm used to... I play Potemkin.
You're used to, it's not the slowness that bothers you. It's not the heavy signing a contract with the punch you're about to throw that bugs you.
I play Potemkin. I'm used to moving like a slow-moving semi.
Sure.
I mean, that goes at 5 miles per hour and occasionally does a charge attack that is not safe on block, and now you're getting punished for it because it's obvious right. That you're doing it.
Sure. But you were, I mean, you know, in tremendous contrast, you were, correct me if I'm wrong, the number one K. Rool in the Boston area for a minute there? Is that...
For a hot minute. I was for a bit, and then there's a better player, and I was really hoping he was from New Hampshire, so then I could just maintain this quote-unquote title for no effort. And literally anybody, if anybody from the Boston, or from the New England Smash scene, like, I say it to game devs, and they get all impressed, and everyone in the Smash scene is just like, yeah, whatever, Penguin. Like, I got fifth place once, twice.
I mean, that ain't nothing. I understand that if you're, it's that weird thing where, like, as a Smash player, that is objectively impressive within, like, the upper echelon of the best players in the world. I get that's like, that may not be the same thing as being the winner of a, like, international tournament or whatever. It's that in that weird liminal space.
We have Mars. He goes to our weeklies. He takes our money every week. He is the fifth best player in the world officially. And between 2 and 5, it was a very, very, very close race between the second to fifth best players. So, like, yeah. And then we also have Light in Connecticut, who's the 10th best player in the world. And if you got a monthly tournament that has over 100 entrants, guess who's going to be first and second place? Probably. And after them, you have like 6 people who are all contenders for third and have also upset the first and best players before. Like, it's mega stacked here. Yeah. And I'm just little old me. And I'm like, I try to break even. I try to go win, lose.
Sure.
It's just so stressful, though. So I've like, I don't think I'll ever compete anymore, but I will go to tournaments just to play friendlies because I have a great time playing friendlies, but I don't have a great time always getting stressed out.
Yeah, that's fair. When you have played at a competitive level, has it, you've mentioned fighting games so far. Has that been your genre? Like Smash specifically, but then you mentioned Zangief.
Yeah, so I would say that Ultimate was the game that I took the most seriously. I also very much enjoy Melee and Project M, but I have never won a set in any of those local tournaments just because I would always be like really low seed, as I should be, and the people I play would be better than me. And like, sure, cool. Sure. I've not actually gone to any of the local FGC meetings. I mean to, but they just kind of are at awkward times compared to other things. So that's just kind of unfortunate. But I do know that we have a great like local TO who does a lot of stuff, and the community is pretty cool and strong. But like, yeah, outside of pre Smash Ultimate, Tekken, and Team Fortress 2, I play like the big slow heavy characters and everything.
Gotcha.
I have like 26 fighting games on my Steam account.
That rules. Do you have a sense of why? Why you gravitate toward the big, slow, heavy characters?
Oh, I know exactly why. Yeah. And the reason was because when my friends got me into League of Legends, way back when, sure. I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I was really bad, and I was just really struggle-bussing and felt like I couldn't do anything successfully. So then I'm like, who is good at not dying? And then I learned about tanking as a role, and then I learned about, hey, you don't have to kill people to be a good tank. You just have to not die and be very obtrusive. And then I learned more about peeling, and I learned more about initiating, and just kind of naturally. And now I have a very good intuition for it. And so I was just like, hey, I love not dying. And then when you sure. are a grappler, you're just like, ooh, I got that pile driver. I got that big grapple. And now you're in the vortex of like, what am I going to do next? Grapple again. So like, there's a game called Fantasy Strike that I was basically at one point master ranked in, and I did some tournaments, but unfortunately the format is a 3v3 format, and so there are only two grapplers right now, and I need a third grappler in order to truly succeed.
Sure.
So yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah. I'm always interested in people who create games and are also really involved in a competitive scene for one game or another. I mean, not just because like in the obvious sense of like, but you're not writing music for fighting games. What's the deal with that? I'm sure you would if
the
opportunity came up. Yeah, exactly.
Would love to.
Yeah. But in the sense of like, I'm always interested in like what got you invested in Ultimate or in Smash in general, right? Like it was just the fact that there was some seed of you realized you could do one thing, and then you realized there were more advanced techniques that were within reach, and so you just like kept going, right? Like it just Yeah.
It's like a simple with that, any right? multiplayer game. It's a matter of like you're interested in it. You play with friends. You get better over time. You learn more technique. You learn more stuff. Like specifically lately, I've been playing some Apex Legends, and that game stresses me the heck out because I am bad at shooting. I'm awful at shooting. And for a long time, I only used shotguns because I couldn't aim for anything because my frame rate was so low because I was playing on a garbage laptop. I still can't aim for anything, which is why when I do play like Overwatch, I play Reinhardt and Winston, the tanks that don't aim. And sure. I also play some D.Va, who aims at least a little bit more.
But in Apex Legends, you could just get close, so it didn't matter that you couldn't shoot. Yeah. That was that. Yeah.
Apex Legends is more about what gun can I find, and also, can I play Gibraltar effectively? Spoilers, no.
Sure. Yeah, that game stresses me out, too. And it's also, it's a really good game. It's a very, very good game. No, I don't know. And I, especially if I'm playing with friends, I can find tremendous joy in being bad at something. I don't know, like a co-op experience where everything's going wrong, or, you know, or a battle royale where we're not going to win, but we're going to stick together and stick it out. Like, I don't know, that to me, that can be a really good experience. I know for some people who play games, the very fact of losing is so negative and so unpleasant that it kind of kills the joy until they can get to a certain level. But I don't know, for me, the disaster can be part of the fun.
Yeah, there's I like lose almost every single firefight that I'm in. I just like collecting stuff and running around with the people I play with.
No, totally. There's a lot to that. So I do want to ask a little bit about your games for Zelgor, stuff like Noobs in Space, because I think your work on them is really good. Was that pipeline a little bit more prescriptive? Were you given, you know, tones, genres, like guidelines to work in? In contrast to, like, I get the sense that with Watch the Space or with Kine, there was a certain sense in which you went where the game just felt like it should go. Were things a little bit more prescribed when you were at Zelgor, or did you still have that same kind of freedom to some degree?
So I will say that I needed themes. I asked for themes, and they would give me these themes, and I would write the themes. And the themes started out simple, like there was ice. And then there was an idea of, like, what other worlds might there be. I'm not necessarily sure if I can talk about some of them, but I will say I will say that I wrote a Brunch Galaxy song, and I wrote a underwater disco Atlantis song, and I was like, wow, these were really fun to write for. And so they did give me some outlandish sort of some pretty crazy prompts to work with. The layering was something that I myself just kind of put on myself, and I was like, hey, this is simple, I just need to break it down into four ways, and they're like, yeah, sure, okay. I would say that I definitely wrote a lot more stuff than they had the time to use at the time. They are maybe going to get to a point where they hire me again to write more stuff. But as of now, I don't know the fate of some of the music that I wrote.
Hmm. Fair enough. Well, speaking of things long in the works, I think the first thing of yours I became aware of was KK's Dreamland.
Really?
Yeah. And I didn't realize there was a game attached to it at first. I thought it was like a Josie Brechner Songs for Unmade Worlds kind of thing. And I was like, oh no, it's a game. It's just like long in the works and may never, the ambition may outstrip the ability to finish it. But
that game was supposed to take a month to make.
Yeah. And it didn't quite work out that way.
It never finished.
Yeah.
There's a build somewhere on Itch and it's locked behind a password. And I don't like, I could find it, but I might've left that server. It was fine.
It was locked by the time I was aware that there even was a game. But I love your music for it. I'm a sucker for that stuff that takes the rules of the platform it's aping seriously, which that really does. Like, they sound like Game Boy tracks, but with like a very personal sense of tonality and composition and whatever. Like they rule.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, that's not something you've done too much in later work, right? Like aping the aesthetic of a previous part of video game history. I think you have you're really good at locking into a genre, but is that something you want to return to at some point? I mean, like, is something a little bit chiptunier? Was that part of the appeal of getting into game music originally for you?
I would say that chiptune is not something that I specifically consider myself like a chiptune artist. I have friends that are phenomenal chiptune composers. And they write some like crazy bops. They do all sorts of stuff with synths and whatnot. And I have some friends that write like really, really cute things.
Mm-hmm.
I will do anything. I'll do anything and everything. And if the project asks me to do it, I'll be like, yeah, I get to do this, which I've never done before. Or yeah, I get to do this, which I haven't done in a while. So like I think I really I like my chiptune writing in that game was specifically like really simple. I abided by the rules of having, I think I had only like four tracks, one of like melody, harmony, bass, and percussion. I actually used specific VSTs that were like very traditional, like I think NES synth sound, like NES sounds.
Like the noise channel and the triangle wave and all that.
I could make that with like the synths that I have. Like I have synths and they're like, oh, do you want to just do a triangle wave? Like, of course it can do that. I use the synth that was like very good for sounding specifically like an NES. And as you can imagine, NES and Game Boys didn't sound all too different back then.
Sure.
So there are some people who write a little bit more complicated stuff and it would take time for me to learn it. I can do anything given enough time.
Yeah. I guess that era of music is interesting both because the tunes had to be bops because you didn't have that much space. So you had to like hook somebody with some kind of like really strong musical idea, but also because like the technical requirements and the musical requirements were both so demanding. Like you really do need a sense of composition to work within those limitations.
All right, bops.
Yeah, you gotta write bops. You gotta write bops. I think, because I mean that, you know, it's a cliche almost to say it, but like when you have, you know, a full orchestra to play with, it's very easy to just do texture. And there's nothing in the world wrong with that, but it's maybe there's a reason those things don't necessarily live in people's brains. Yeah, totally.
It's just a matter of like, so I remember thinking, like, one thing I love about game music is that you have to make sure that certain things are, they don't have to be catchy, but I prefer my music to be catchy. And it has to loop well, and it can't just exist to exist. Like, I remember, I think I was watching Ant-Man and the Wasp, and I had a thought about, like, wait, there's music in this movie, and the music exists, and I describe it as shredded lettuce, where it exists for texture, but no nutritional value whatsoever.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of cinematic music can just get like this, where like not all cinematic music is like this. Like my sister brought up the Shape of Water soundtrack, which is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And I love Amelie, which also has a gorgeous soundtrack. But a lot of times cinematic music just doesn't really have anything that like sticks with your head. it's like texture. And so I think music that exists to be textural has its place, but I personally want my music to be remembered. I want to write music that matters to me, because the music that I grew up with, I can sing. If I hear a song out of context, sometimes even a sound effect, if I hear a sound effect out of context, it will take me back 15 years to the moment that I played that game. And that game mattered a lot to me. And I want to be able to do that equivalent with my music. And so, like, I don't want to write just, like, ambient textual stuff that people don't remember. I want to be able to write things that stick in people's minds, that people will be like, wow, I really love the music for that game. And I want to be, if other people did it to me, I want to be able to give back, in a sense.
Totally, yeah.
Write cool shit.
Well, yeah, and then take advantage of the opportunities. I mean, like, the idea what you're talking about with Watch the Space, with every character having a theme, that rules. I mean, like, and I think it's totally fair to contrast that with the Marvel movies, which are the example of missing that opportunity. Like, imagine how cool Endgame could have been if every character had a theme or whatever. Like, someone had to point out to me that Ant-Man even has a theme, because it's so nothing. It's just like this sort of generic kind of spy music stuff, right? Like the Avengers themselves have that one melody that's sort of recognizable, but otherwise those movies don't really bother. And that's such a waste. It's crazy. it's bizarre. It's the opposite of, you know, a John Williams approach or whatever, where everything has
apparently the old Justice League cartoon, every single character had their own theme. Huh. And they would, and those themes would rise and fall depending on like the actions of the thing. And that's really cool. That rules. I love themes. Yeah. But the only theme of a modern superhero that I know of off the top of my head is the Wonder Woman one. Hmm. Just because it's really distinct. And I also hear it in this Korean variety show a lot for some reason. Don't ask.
I mean, I'm curious, but if you don't want to talk about it, that's fine.
It's just like this, like there are these Korean variety shows and they use a lot of random music that they probably aren't allowed to. But like,
yeah,
one of them is the Wonder Woman theme.
Interesting. Interesting. I think, well, so like Miles has a theme in Into the Spider-Verse. In fact, there's a bunch of like motif kind of stuff going on in that movie with that like that little octave-y melody when he's not sure about his responsibilities and the leap of faith and like all that stuff. Like there's a bunch of that. But that movie is maybe the exception that proves the rule in a bunch of ways.
That movie is so good. I will still say that I don't remember much of the music outside of Watch Out Danger.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
That is the theme that I, or like that music in that specific moment too.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so beautifully directed. It's incredible.
That's a good example though. Cause when you hear the What's Up Danger track, even on the soundtrack, it doesn't have that theme, but in the movie it does. They layer like the soundtracking on top of the music.
I need to watch this movie again.
Yeah.
I've seen it four times and I need to see it. I need to take one time just so that I can like slow down and watch all those like very specific, really cool animation stuff that I would never be able to watch with someone else because it would just be so obnoxious. Like, all right, I got to see it again and again. Just need to appreciate the work that they do.
And so much love went into that movie. Yeah, it's unreal.
Oh, it's so good. And everyone that worked on the movie apparently loved working on it and they're just so proud of it. And they should be. It's so good.
I mean, that's the difference, right? There's an obvious difference in the end product when people are excited and given the space to work. Because that's the other thing, right? Like, it was so different than what you think of as a traditional crunch scenario for animators, where, like, you know, a friend of a friend did the shot of Gwen drumming in her band and got months to do that. That's not how things always go on movies, on games, whatever.
I saw that Twitter post, too, where it was just like, this is what I did and this is how I did it. And you're just like, I'm not an animator, but I can appreciate animation. And when you explain to me like this stuff, I'm like, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's incredibly cool. It's incredibly cool. Yeah,
I'm just thinking about it.
Oh, yeah. So it's so good. Every little thing like that. I mean, you know, I don't think it's too crazy to make the connection that I feel like you have a similar interest in just like attention to detail. And like I feel like you're on that wavelength. Like it's not for like anybody can talk about how good Into the Spider-Verse is. But like, We're plugging into this for a reason. Like, I think some of your work is definitely in that lane where you put love in the details. And like, it makes total sense that you're trying to, as you say, give back. I love that way of thinking of it, to the art that got you going. Like, that's amazing. That's what it is, right? That to make someone else feel what you felt when the stuff that you loved the most came into your life. Like, that's, what is this if it's not that?
Yeah, I'm a really passionate person. And when I see that passion poured into the craft, I'm not always able to to see it, but if it is pointed out to me, I can acknowledge it. And like that movie specifically bleeds it. But there are certain things where like I didn't love The Last of Us, but then like someone was explaining the UI of like the backpack system. I'm like, wow, you're right. That was so smooth and easy. And you don't think about it. Good UI and good sound effects are the kind of things that like when they're amazing, you might not even notice it.
Yeah, yeah.
With the exception maybe being Persona 5 just because it's pizzazz and it's really in your face. But like a beautiful UI that's just painless to interface with. Like when someone explains to me it, I might not notice it from the get-go. And I'm getting better at noticing certain things now. But like if someone's like, this is how this works and this is why it's so beautiful and elegant, I'm like, design. Oh, incredible. Oh, I love good design. Yeah.
My wife is in theater and it's always like the classic thing is sound design. You only notice sound design in live theater when something goes wrong, right? Like it's almost to a lay audience, it's completely transparent. It's just like, I can hear the person singing. Like it's, you know, it's perfect. When something goes wrong, it's incredibly obvious. So yeah.
That's how it be sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. It can be thankless in a certain way. Okay. One more big question, which is one of the things I find interesting, and you have commented on this before, so if you're tired of getting asked this question, fair enough, but I'm interested in the fact that you are a multi-instrumentalist, but you lean on synths and MIDI and all that kind of stuff pretty heavily in your work, and there's no contradiction there, but I wonder, like, is that something you're itching to do? You know, mix the two a little bit more, or does the fact that you're trying to be so modular sort of tie you to a more synth-based approach in general?
So I would say that my main compositions workflow is that I write music in MuseScore first, typically.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to be Finale, but I fucking hate Finale so much.
Can I say really quickly? Every time I've ever heard you mention Finale, you have editorialized how much you hate it. Like there's a blood feud going on here.
Yeah. Oh, I paid money for this program. That's shit.
Yeah, yeah.
I hate it so much, but I use MuseScore, which is free. And it's not perfect, but it's pretty dang good.
Yeah.
And it's free. So, yeah, every single time I talk about Finale, I always have to mention I hate it. But I write it in MIDI first, and then I pour it into the DAW. I humanize the MIDI, and it makes it more flexible if I want to change the instruments for if I want to be like, oh, I'm doing modular stuff. Like for Kind, I had like, this is a stem from the accordion theme. This is a stem from the trombone theme. And I have them layered together when they're on a date together. And it's like, oh, and I use That's different really instruments cool. for that point. I find that live recording is frustrating because of all the small human things. I am a pretty dang good bass trombone player, but I'm not at my peak anymore. I'm not in my prime. And there are just a lot of things that I'm like, it's a little out of tune here and there. And I can do some post-processing and stuff like that, but just the slight editing of like moving things forward and backwards or up and down, it's just a little bit of a pain to me. And though I should do it more because I have the capabilities of doing it, it's the thing that I find more frustrating to interface with. And hybridizing VSTs and real instruments, I think, is really good, but is also just kind of a pain.
Yeah, no, totally, totally. Well, because, all the stuff that makes it great about a human performance can also make it bad and can make it especially hard to work with when your goal is a graceful loop or to modularize it with stuff that is going to be like exactly pitch perfect, right? Like very, very few humans can do that consistently. It takes like a lifetime of skill to be able to do that. So that makes total sense.
Yeah, I recorded some singing and guess what? Not all my singing's in tune.
I mean, no one's singing is always in tune. That's, it's the nature of the human voice, I was mentioning my wife's in theater. She, she went to school for opera performance, right? So she's like, she's as close to absolutely consistent as a human voice is going to get. And she still listens to her recording of herself and goes, I hate this, get rid of it, like delete that. And
all too relatable.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Well, it's really good to meet you and thank you again for taking the time and fuck Finale, fuck Pro Tools. We didn't actually say that, but
fuck Pro Tools.
When I was doing my research, I was happy to find someone else who feels as passionately on that point. But thank you again and have a good one.
You too.
And that's the show. Watch This Space will be out on Steam on February 9th. Kind is out now on Steam, as well as in the Epic Store, on Google Stadia, and on Nintendo Switch, PlayStation 4, and Xbox One. Only Cans is out now on itch.io.
The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast is hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger Michaels, with support not only on the show, but on Saying Fuck Pro Tools from Francis Michelle Cannon and Lucio Valentino. Our logo is by Aaron Perry Zucker using icons from the Noun Project. You can find the show everywhere podcasts are a thing, including but not limited to wherever you are listening to it right now. If you'd like to support the show, and you can do so at patreon.com/ETAO. Thanks tremendously to our current patrons, with a very, very special thank you to the mysterious Ian K., Lucas Cosen, and Darth Raptora. You can also support the show by buying something on our Nexus page at nexus.gg/ETAO. The lion's share goes to the developers, a little bit goes to the platform, and a little bit goes to us. That's cool. We're on Twitter at ETAOPod. We stream on Twitch, YouTube, and Periscope recently for some reason. Sure, watch us play games. I've been playing some old N64 games recently. I streamed some Tetrisphere. I'm going to stream some others. Come hang out if you want to do that. And we'll be back in 2 weeks, seriously this time, on that timeline with another episode. Until then, do take care. We'll see you next time.